This is the session called Thinking About Lived Theology from the Context of the Congo by John Keese, who recently, I guess just in the past few days, right, walked at Duke and received his PhD. You've been living in New York for a couple of years, and now you're going to Loyola College. When I was there, it was Loyola College, Loyola University. It's very exciting to have you back. John begins his appointment at Loyola in, I guess, September, completed his PhD from Duke. I'll say just a couple of words about him. Was a social and political thought major here at University of Virginia, and became involved in the project as a fourth year, and then spent 2 or 3 years doing community building and organizing in Charlottesville, and you were a catalyst in sort of those early years of the project, making important connections with the community, helping define the mission, building bridges with friendships and organizations that have been sustained over the long period of time, 11 years, I guess we've been doing this. So after UVA, you won all kinds of things, Mitchell Fellow in Belfast, and then an MPhil at Cambridge. And you've been actively involved in peacemaking initiatives in the Great Lakes regions of Africa under the auspices of Duke Divinity School Center for Reconciliation. You might know that Emmanuel Cantagalo was here a few weeks ago speaking to a group. His doctoral dissertation focuses on the problem of war and Christian ethics through the lens of the Democratic Republic of Congo, where he conducted field work in 2008-2009. In addition to his work on conflict and peacemaking, John is also interested in political theology, political theory, and philosophy, and I was so excited to read this today. He's currently working on a book entitled Hannah Arendt and Theology. TNT is under contract with TNT Clark. Fantastic. So welcome back, John.
Well, I'm well aware of what time it is in the day, and we're hungry, so thank you in advance for your patience. I really appreciate it. I'm going to read from a paper. It should be about 20 minutes, and I'd love to talk about this. There's already plenty of overlap. There's a memoir in here and echoes of Romero, and so thinking about lived theology from the context of the Congo. Much of my recent thinking on issues of method, style, and pedagogy has been shaped by my doctoral research on the war in the Democratic Republic of Congo. I would like to draw upon this research to reflect on the ways that attention to lived theologies in contexts of protracted conflict, state collapse, and displacement can significantly challenge the ways that these settings tend to be theorized. At stake here, as Manuel Vasquez and Mary McClintock Fulkerson have argued, is how our very method shapes the way situations are framed. In the case of the war in the Congo, this methodological point takes on a special urgency, given that the methods that produce conventional framings of this conflict, focused as they are on traditional media and the discourse of states and rebel actors, often present civilians in the reductive terms of voicelessness, bare life, and victimhood. This, in turn, mobilizes further reaching anthropological claims about the boundaries between the human and the inhuman. Research in the Congo has taught me to see that our very capacity to acknowledge enduring human particularity depends upon what Vina Das calls a descent into the ordinary, a methodological move to the domain of the everyday, where one seeks to attend to what is shown as much as what is said, and where one can dwell in time long enough to see signs of injury become the very means through which agency is recovered. To help illustrate the ways that attention to lived theologies complicates conventional accounts of war and the position of civilians in it, let me present 3 scenes from the Congo. The first takes place in the eastern city of Bukavu in the year 2000. The Rally for Congolese Democracy, a regional rebel group, had occupied the city since 1998 and attempted to impose a local form of political authority, claiming the state prerogatives of taxation, trade, and protection. This attempt did not go unchallenged, and the Catholic Church in Bukavu, led by its Archbishop Emmanuel Catalico, spearheaded the opposition. On Christmas Eve in 1999, Archbishop Catalico preached an electrifying sermon denouncing the RCD's many abuses, from excessive taxation and illegal exploitation of resources to killings against activists and attacks against churches. His sermon inspired a citywide strike as Catholic and Protestant churches, joined by Muslim and other members of the civil society, closed schools and clinics along with markets and transportation, bringing the life of the city to a halt. The RCD responded by exiling Catalico, which prompted another round of strikes and an international campaign to return him. Catalico did eventually return, 7 months later, to throngs gathered at the cathedral where he presided over a public Eucharist that was attended by 40,000 people. But he was soon forced into exile again, where he eventually died from what many believe was poisoning by the RCD. Catalico's body was received in Bukavu in October 2000. A funeral procession began at the airport and moved toward the city center. In the Archdiocese video footage of the event, tens of thousands of Bukavu residents can be seen lining the streets. In the crowds, one can observe a range of emotions. Some church groups have gathered to offer hymns of thanksgiving. Other residents are more visibly grief-stricken, calling out to their leader and striking their chests in lament. Some stretch out their arms. Others bow their heads. Some kneel, while others lock shoulder to shoulder. At about the midpoint of the procession, the event is interrupted by gunshots. The mourners scatter. Some throw themselves behind walls and fences, while others drop to the ground. One can see several women huddled together, the brilliance of their yellow and blue floral patterned dresses covered in the mud. When the gunshots finally stop, a silence spreads out across the streets. After several minutes, one begins to hear a murmur in the crowd. Some slowly begin to stand up. Others follow them. A crowd moves back toward the truck that was carrying Catalico's body. The wheels begin to turn again. The hymns begin again. The crowd of mourners continue their procession and take the body of their fallen leader to the cathedral for burial. The second scene takes place in a refugee camp near the town of Erangi in 1996. Marie Beatrice Umutezi was one of the 1 million Hutu refugees who had poured into Congo in the aftermath of the Rwandan genocide, creating one of the worst humanitarian catastrophes in recent memory, resulting in the death of 1,000 people a week from cholera alone. While many of these refugees were former genocide perpetrators in ex-Interahamwe, the vast majority of them were not. As the armed genocide perpetrators continued to launch attacks into Rwanda, and the weak Congolese state did nothing to stop it, the Rwandan government decided to end the situation and began shelling the camps, prompting a mass repatriation to Rwanda. But because many of the Interahamwe were using refugees as shields, Umutezi was forced to flee further west. In her memoir, Umutezi provides the harrowing account of her year-long flight through the jungles of Congo, fleeing both the genocide perpetrators and the Rwandan army. She and the girls she adopted along the way fled from camp to camp until they eventually came to Erangi. She describes her arrival. Erangi, where we stayed about 2 weeks, is on the stretch of paved road between Bukavu and Kisangani, about 92 kilometers from Bukavu. The refugees had put up their blindés all around a former hotel. It soon became a camp that was really a prison. In the event of a rebel attack, we had little chance of escaping. There was only one exit, and a few well-armed tiri guarded it. Those who tried to leave were robbed of all their belongings, molested, and even killed. And yet, she writes, in the prison of Erangi, I rediscovered prayer. She recounts how a woman named Immaculée, whom she befriended along the way, helped her. It was thanks to Immaculée that I again found the words that had been lost for so long. With her, she says she learned the Lord's Prayer, the Creed, the Gloria, and other prayers that I had forgotten. Later, quote, my daughters taught me religious songs that I sang often, even on the road or when I was fetching water. The songs that I loved the most were Nire Bombe, Indaji, Unyakiri, Lord, I come to you, welcome me, and E Wowe Rutari Ruwanji, you are my rock. Umutezi says, after praying, I felt restored. Thanks to my faith, I was able to bear the daily humiliations, deprivation, sickness, and misery better. As she goes on, the most important thing that Immaculate taught me, which continued to help me even when we were no longer together, is to accept God in everyday life, to accept him like a loving father who comes to our aid every time we call on him, even for the smallest things in life. This faith would be my greatest support during the years spent in the equatorial forests of Congo. The third scene is taken from the town of Nyankundi, located in the northeastern province of Ituri, where I conducted 5 months of fieldwork in 2009. The town of Nyankundi was destroyed in 2002 during one of the worst attacks of the war. The town had been the center of a large missionary hospital, a market, schools, and the homes and farms of thousands of families. On the morning of September 5th, 2002, Ngidi militia attacked the town, seeking out Hema and Bira in homes, streets, and even in the hospital. In all, 1,200 people died, and all of the survivors were displaced. The town remained empty until a small group of residents decided to return 2 years later. With militias continuing to roam 15 kilometers outside the town, the decision was wrenching. But for one of the returnees, a doctor named Mike Upio, it was a clear one. The International Rescue Committee estimates that 5.4 million people have died during the Congo War, making it the deadliest conflict since World War II. Most of these casualties, however, are civilians, and most of them have never been near a battlefield. These deaths are the result of the indirect costs of war, the disease and malnutrition that results from displacement, the destruction of public infrastructure, and the loss of traditional forms of livelihood. During one of my stays in Nyankundi, Dr. Upio invited me into the operating suite of the CME hospital, which he was rebuilding one ward at a time for the past 5 years. A woman had arrived for a C-section, a relatively straightforward procedure that has been unavailable in many rural areas, resulting in countless birth-related deaths. In the operating room, Dr. Upio began by making several incisions and then pulling the webbing of her skin apart, delivered the limp body of a baby. He handed the child to a nurse who gently wrapped its back, and peals of newborn wailing filled the operating room. Dr. Upio then turned back to the woman and began to deliver a second child from her womb. This time, when the nurse wrapped the child's back, however, there was no motion. After repeated attempts to get the baby breathing, Dr. Upio stopped and put the child down. The mother walked 20 kilometers last night to get here, he said. I don't know if the second one was ever alive, but the first is alive, and the mother is alive. Three scenes from the war in the Congo, three scenes in Live Theology. How might attention to such scenes complicate the way war and displacement are conventionally narrated? Perhaps the most pervasive descriptive trope that accompanies accounts of civilian life in Congo is that of voicelessness. Evelyn Gordon, writing in Commentary magazine, provides a representative example of this when she observes, quote, "The world rarely hears about Congo because groups such as Amnesty and Human Rights Watch have left the victims largely voiceless, preferring instead to focus on far less serious abuses in developed countries where gathering information is easier." Gordon expresses two common assumptions here, not only that those in Congo are voiceless, but that they can only achieve voice through the speech of Western advocacy groups. French anthropologist Didier Fasson describes how second-generation humanitarianism, associated with the rise of such groups as Médecins Sans Frontières and Médecins du Monde, differs from first-wave humanitarianism on precisely this score. Whereas the Red Cross made a policy of not testifying on behalf of the victims they assisted, MSF and other groups deliberately speak out as witnesses to injustice. The role of the witness shifts from the person who experiences suffering to the person who tries to alleviate it. Moreover, the suffering is often translated into familiar Western idioms, whether it is the language of Conrad's language of the Heart of Darkness, Hobbes' State of Nature, the clinical language of trauma or the legal language of crimes against humanity. Regardless of the idiom, the assumption is that the victims have been deprived of voice, and thus the humanitarian must supply it. But what if speech, as Vasquez and McClintock-Fulkerson have argued, does not exhaust the possible registers of voice? Let us return for a moment to the scene of Archbishop Catalico's funeral. Speech is not a prominent feature in this scene, but the mourners are hardly voiceless. There is a range of bodily gestures that are crucial to the whole unfolding drama of the situation, from the cries and laments of the mourners to the ongoing movement of their bodies after the RCD threatened to disrupt the funeral. An entire metaphysics, says Pierre Bourdieu, is contained in the bodily habitus of a culture. In this scene, we see the mourners body forth their voice and express a number of fundamentally crucial theological claims. On the one hand, the unflinching determination to extend full burial rights to Catalico makes a claim about his own humanity. It displays and confirms the worth of a life that the RCD's own politics called into question. If the mourners dispersed and did not bury Catalico, the claim that this life was somehow not fully human life could continue to breathe. That the mourners put their own lives on the line, however, displays the worth of his life. It also buries the RCD's attempt to introduce a sliding scale in human worth. Responding to the occupation of another city, St. Augustine spoke about how burial is not only a confirmation of the humanity of the dead, but an expression of the hope for bodily resurrection. Care for the dead body, for Augustine, was unintelligible, apart from the expectation that all flesh shall be given back and made whole in a moment of time. The way mourners care for Catalico's body displays this same hope for resurrection, but in a way that brings this future resurrection into the present. Going on with the funeral in the face of violence displays the future victory over death now, opening a way of being in the world beyond fear of death. In this way, their mourning bodies forth the resurrection. In so doing, it challenges the sovereignty of the RCD at its deepest point, as this sovereignty was grounded in precisely the power and fear of death. No longer subject to death, the mourners are no longer subject to the RCD. Their uninterrupted mourning turns the tables and makes the sovereignty of the RCD subject to the sovereignty of good. In this respect, the burial of Catalico, much like Antigone's burial of Polynices, is not only a protest of an unjust law or form of rule, but more fundamentally, more positively, it is the reconstitution of the ordinary that the law's violence has threatened to disrupt. It is a constructive act, an attempt to re-inhabit a devastated space and make it hospitable again. It reweaves the ordinary in the very face of violence and uses the signs of injury as the very means of making a home. Such a public act of worship not only reconstitutes the church, but in part also the ordinary life of the city, suggesting something about the ambiguous boundaries between church and city, and as McClintock-Fulkerson suggests, the worldly character of the church. If attention to lived theology helps us acknowledge the voice of those assumed to be voiceless, such attention also helps challenge a related description, that of bare life. Philosopher Giorgio Agamben is the most recent in a long line of thinkers going back to Aristotle, who distinguishes two forms of life, the bare biological life that human beings share with animal and vegetative life, and the qualified biographical life that makes human life distinctively human. For Agamben, like Aristotle, it is language that makes human beings different from other animals, and thus the loss of language is concomitant with the loss of the human. Stripped of citizenship and the conditions necessary for speech and action, the refugee represents the quintessential figure of bare life. The assumption here, as in many accounts of refugees, is that once a refugee crosses a national boundary, the refugee is stripped of the specificity of culture, place, and history, and is human in the most elemental sense, or, in Agamben's case, no longer human at all. But if we return to the scene of Marie Beatrice Umutezi in the camp of Arengi, we find the kind of reduction of Agamben and other theorists is challenged on multiple fronts. And Mutesi's experience of exile is not some neutral, bare experience universally shared by all refugees. Her experience continues to be marked by history, culture, and identity. First and foremost, her experience of exile is gendered at every point, as she has to repeatedly escape the sexual advances of men throughout her entire journey. Her experience is also deeply marked by ethnic identity, as her shared Hutu affiliation with genocide perpetrators makes her the target of relentless attacks by the Rwandan army. But it is perhaps her Catholic identity that challenges Agamben's account most profoundly. Her practice of prayer and song, and the way this fosters a sense of precarious community among her fellow travelers, and a visceral sense of God's presence even in the stifling conditions of the camp, directly challenges the sense that she has lost speech. But more fundamentally, it challenges any easy separation of biological and biographical life. In prayer, body and biography, biological and qualified life intersect, mutually articulating one another in the non-reductive ways that Manuel Vasquez has unpacked for us so well. There is no ghost outside the city gates, no bare life separable from human life. Rather, Umutezi's posture of prayer displays an ongoing relationship with God, grounding the human not through language or membership in a state, but more fundamentally in ongoing relationship with God. Such a posture makes the improbable claim that dehumanization is not actually within our power. No place is God-forsaken, and thus no place gives us privileged access into a bare life distinguishable from our biographical journey into God. Such a display makes the alleviation of injustice no less urgent, but it makes such alleviation contingent upon the acknowledgement of Umutezi as a woman, a Hutu, and a Catholic. In short, it requires recognition of her enduring human identity. To look for lived theologies in contexts of war is not only to look for voice beyond speech, but particularity beyond bare life. These points about voice and identity connect to a final point about agency. Descriptions that emphasize voicelessness and bare life often end up reducing civilians to victimhood. Such analysis focuses on particular violent events, whether they be dislocation, the destruction of a town, or bodily violation. While this rightly focuses on what civilians suffer, it does not go on to explore how civilians suffer it. Anthropologist Lisa Malke has called attention to the lived meaning of dislocation, which she argues is differently constituted depending on a range of factors and contexts. Instead of taking suffering as a given, one must trace the ways that signs of injury are inhabited, re-inhabited, worked through, and in some cases become the very basis of the recovery of agency. To appreciate this agency, however, requires the crucial element of time. Vina Das speaks of how violent events are carried forward and backward in time, how such events ripple or echo into the realm of the everyday, how they are never over and done with, but continue through their multiple effects. For Das, understanding violence, particularly mass violence that disrupts the very foundation of ordinary grammar, requires a descent into the ordinary, where violent events have an afterlife, and where a consideration of this afterlife becomes a way of moving beyond narratives of victimhood to consider how people suffer and transform violence in time. This, for Das, is why an ethnographic sensibility is particularly important. Returning to our third scene, the town of Nyankunde, an analysis of this town could end with the 2002 attack. But the return of Dr. Upio and other residents shows how this violence continues to be negotiated, and that its very damage is now the basis of new forms of agency. Rather than a fate that must be suffered, residents are reconfiguring the very nature of what they've suffered in the way they are living with it. The attack no doubt destroyed the foundations of the town. It disrupted ordinary life in so total a way life will never be ordinary in the same way again. But by returning to the ruins, by rebuilding the hospital, by being willing to inhabit a space of devastation, residents are able to reweave a new ordinary out of the ruins of the old. A hospital that was once staffed by Western missionaries that treated common maladies is now a hospital staffed by Congolese doctors who are mitigating the indirect costs of war through C-sections in their own backyard. In re-inhabiting such broken institutions, Resonance bodied forth a local soteriology, a way of redemption that does not leap into another worldly transcendence, but lingers among the ruins and recovers agency through a form of wounded healing. A research sensibility that does not reduce voice to speech, but seeks to attend to theological voices in other registers, is not simply an important methodological resource in the study of theology or conflict. In settings where assumptions about voicelessness often enable deeper assumptions about victimhood and the limits of the human, such a sensibility becomes an essential moral resource. Sounding for lived theologies in places such as Congo is not first about gaining new knowledge. It is about responding to a claim for recognition. It is about acknowledgement. A failure to acknowledge, a failure to hear the voice of lived theology in places of dislocation is, to borrow again the words of Veena Das, not a failure of the intellect, it is a failure of the spirit. Thanks. On your dollar.
Yeah, you were presenting all your sort of your research.
Yeah.
But you lacked a thesis that's really exciting in this kind of company. I mean, it wasn't like you didn't know you lacked a thesis.
Right.
You started off by saying, I don't know. I'm not a genius. You told me.
Yeah.
I'm interested in giving voice to. And what you do theologically with that. And a simple question is, you're putting Augustinian understanding of bodily resurrection, you're reading it that way.
Yeah.
Did you interview anyone who was part of that funeral, and how did they understand their kind of actions and the decision to carry on with the funeral?
Yeah.
How did they frame it? Is that your theological reading, something you see, or is that the Congolese theology of what?
Yeah. That's a great question. A couple things. First, I began the project thinking it was going to be entirely ethnographic-based, and what ended up happening is when I talked to folks, they would point me to other events or stories, and this was a story that kept coming up, and it actually made it a much more of a historical project. And so I've been reflecting a lot on the materials that I used for this project, and this is really based on an amateur video that was recorded by someone. So I didn't actually talk to people who were part of it. I talked to people who had lived in Bukavu at that time and were probably there, but we didn't address the actual. And so most of this is based on kind of observation. And what I don't talk about here is that there's a wonderful archive of Archbishop Catalico's sermons and letters in Bukavu. And so some of the themes of resurrection are quite explicit. And so this would have been in the air. And so I would say some of that is actually genuinely reflects. But I would want to actually say that there is a lot of me in that reading, and it's important that there's a lot of me in it. And the reason why is I've mentioned Veena Das quite a lot. She's been really important for my work, and she talks about how often social sciences lack sufficient languages for pain, and that while they go out to know pain, rarely does social science be transformed by that encounter. And so she says the goal is not to know, but to be known, to reflect the marking of an encounter. And so this is my attempt to say the result of my encounter with the funeral is refracted onto my voice. And so it made me go to Augustine, but it made me talk about Augustine in relation to what I thought was a much more realized eschatology that isn't necessarily present in Augustine. And so I think at first I was expecting, oh, how am I going to speak in the voice? And that's clearly a major commitment of mine. But I very proudly say that it's really, the theologian's voice here is quite important. And if, as Das puts it, the goal is to become a textual body upon which the pain of others can be written. And I think that's a worthy goal.
Say that again slowly.
The goal is to become a textual body upon which the pain of others can be written, which I think is is a helpful way of redeeming textual registers in a way that also recognizes, as both books have pointed out, that there's a bodily dimension that can't be translated into writing.
So I can't help but think about it, it's fabulous. I can't help but when you talk about giving voice to the voiceless, think of Spivak. And think of the idea of can the subaltern speak.
Absolutely.
The conclusion that the only way to speak is that the subaltern is through death.
Right.
And I really appreciate what you did with the idea of speech there and kind of saying, okay, there's other ways to speak.
Yeah.
You know, in action, this kind of category you're working with.
Yeah.
The three occasions. People are speaking through action, but they don't have words that they're allowed to use to express it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if you could reflect for a minute on what that insight does for theology as a whole.
Yeah.
Because theology is often thought of as books and writing, being people of the book.
Mm.
But you're challenging that entire notion of how theology is thought about traditionally. That there's action, it is lived theology.
Mm-hmm.
It's in many ways seeking to redefine through these examples from the Congo how theology has been understood. What do you think of my reading of?
That's very helpful. I've often, just to build off the point about genre, and I mean, if this is irreducibly bodily, how could it actually, and to what degree, to your comments about this urge we feel to do second order reflection, when in fact it's all in the first order. And Nicholas Adams has a really helpful essay called Ethnography is Dogmatics, and he says, we'll finish this essay by doing some second-order reflection, but it's completely unnecessary. In fact, it almost defeats our argument to add it, but this is the Scottish Journal of Theology. I'm actually really wrestling with that. Obviously, it's manifested itself in words, and I still think that's quite important. I mean, Charles mentioned I'm working on a book on Hannah Arendt. She talks about the importance of thinking what we're doing. It's interesting. She's critical of Marx by when Marx says the goal of philosophy is to change, and she actually takes a step back and says, well, perhaps that doesn't allow sufficient time to let the world act upon us. You know, we're changing it. So for thinking what we're doing is an attempt to kind of say, well, hold on. I mean, the task of contemplation and reflection is actually quite important. And so I do think that's part of the labor of theology. But I do want to hold with that kind of tension of how this kind of challenges genre and stuff. Yeah?
Actually, I have to turn to a similar question, I think. And this is, it's about language, but I think it's not just about second order reflection. It's fairly broad. It can be addressed to Manuel or probably anyone else who presented. But it seems that you've talked about people doing theology or using things other than human speech and voices to show something or to be something. And so you could see a video, right, of the funeral procession and see what happened there. But there does seem to be a push for we human beings, I'll generalize broadly, seem to have this urge then to want to tell those stories, even if it's person who participated in that funeral procession telling her story even before the second order reflection that might go on. This is again a real broad question. I just wonder what you think. Is there something special or unique or particular about language in the way that these things get communicated?
Yeah.
And if so, you know, what would it be? Again, without wanting to denigrate the materiality of that.
Yeah, absolutely.
The body,
yes. That's really helpful. I'm thinking of Talal Asad in Formations of the Secular talks about, he's drawing from Wittgenstein, and he says, we think of pain as an inner experience, but in fact, pain is a social relation. And that means the point of recognition is actually quite important, and that's actually what language is for. And I found the language of acknowledgement, recognition, through language to actually be important moments within pain itself. I mean, so much so that if there isn't a recognition, if there isn't talking about it, there's something incomplete about the relationship of pain, and that's what calls out. So the call for acknowledgement for me suggests the entry point into language, and that In fact, if the voice is not recognized, it's still waiting for that recognition. That's how I'd see like the importance of going beyond, or the need to talk about the witness as actually trying to be faithful to the nature of the witness, what the witness is calling for, and it would be one way of entering into that.
Actually, this question follows perfectly along the lines of our question. I was going to ask you, how would you describe the way in which you were attentive to this textual body as you were writing, or as you were working on this project, particularly perhaps in conversation with Manuel's presentation, but also with Mary's book, there's some what Sarah was talking about too,
yeah,
from the biography and the kind of retelling of one's story. Because I'm asking this question because it sounds, I haven't heard so far a whole lot of self-reflexivity or self-criticism,
yeah,
in regards to how we use language as lit theologians,
right?
How we,
yeah,
are textual and inscribing others as we write.
Mm.
So I just wonder, how are you,
yeah,
attentive to this textual body, and how would you have a conversation with kind of theoretical framework that Manuel is putting?
Yeah, I mean, one question that came up a lot when I was thinking on is lived theology about what the theologian writes in response to what they see, or is lived theology the embodied theology that actually is independent? And Mary's book really kind of challenged me in that direction. And I've thought a lot about my time in the Congo, and one of the things I've thought about just reflects. I've really only spent 5 months there, and that's felt like a long time for me. But I've thought about like if we're really putting ethnography on the table for theologians. I mean, Mary spent several years in Good Samaritan. I think the quality of her narrative reflects that time. And but I think it's important, like how long, like if time really is important. And you know, as Manuel talks about, like tenure requirements. If we're talking about 20 years to actually get into the rhythm of a habitus. Self-critically, I've thought, well, boy, I mean, this is pretty superficial at this stage. So I have wondered about, you know, of on that nature, how much is enough and how far you go and whatnot. Yeah.
John, I really enjoyed the paper, and especially the scenes, the way that you describe the scenes.
Thanks.
So I appreciate it a lot. Thanks. I think my question, again, is maybe along the lines of Ruben's question, but I'm not sure. The way that you set out the paper, it seems like you give us the scenes, and then you basically talk about sort of three different areas of kind of basically what I would describe as broadly secular discourse,
mm-hmm,
about these issues, right? Bare life and victimhood and voicelessness,
yeah,
et cetera. And then you basically sort of use the scenes and some theological reflection to offer corrective,
mm-hmm,
to those descriptions, right? To say those are inadequate descriptions of what's occurring here,
right,
and we can do some theology with the ethnography,
right,
to see that. And my question was about the ways that ethnography may or may not also correct our theological language,
yes,
as well as that other kind.
Yeah.
And you did that a little bit, I think, in response to Peter's question with Augustine, right? Where you say, well, Augustine has this theology of the body of the resurrection, but the eschatology isn't quite realized enough.
Yeah.
And so this scene sort of does that. But
yeah.
So I wonder just more generally what you thought about the ability of these scenes or this ethnographic work to correct,
yeah,
what theologians are doing.
Yeah.
And then what that might tell us about the relationship between, say, theology and experience.
Yeah. That's a brilliant question. The dissertation that some of this is based on is, as Charles said, is looking at the problem of war and Christian ethics. And that was a really challenging, because I felt very constricted by what that debate is usually about. It's almost the fact that Christian ethics really has been satisfied to reduce war to a question between just war theory and pacifism, which is essentially what it is. So, I mean, to me, it's astonishing, but I don't even know how to enter it. So the most immediate theological conversation was this one. It's like, how has a choice between just war theory and pacifism become the way that Christians have thought about war? And in terms of recognition and acknowledgement, I mean, it presumes that we are at the level of the state or at the level of a conscientious objector, and we have the freedom to decide, am I going to support this war? Would this bombing be discriminate or proportional? Whereas I think a context like Congo suggests that that perspective doesn't even exist, that war is actually something that everyone has to, it's concomitant with the social, it's ordinary, it's tied up in the political economy. And so, I mean, in the dissertation I reflect on, well, what description of war are theologians relying on to come up with these options? And in what way can theology make an intervention in the very descriptions that we use to base our ethics? And so, in that sense, I get into Yoder Harawas and Ramsey and O'Donovan, and I just find that the way they're setting up the questions is not helpful. And so that's one of the primary... Yeah.
Sorry, I'll just sneak in a quick follow-up. Can you theorize that a little bit more? Is it not helpful because there's a kind of experience out here that's pressing on that language? Or, like, how would you describe, you know what I mean, the relationship there, like, why that isn't helpful? So this is kind of related to questions about language and the way that you use experience,
etc. Well, part of it is just if just war theory, to take one example, is collective wisdom on the wisdom of Christian teaching, is an attempt to understand how the claim of Christ may be speaking on this. I feel it's a bad interpretation, not only based on interpretation of Scripture, but in the inevitable ways that interpretation has to engage with lived experience. I mean, in some sense, the lived theological witness is kind of a witness against that as an interpretation of Christian teaching. So, I mean, they go back and forth. And so in that sense, I find when Kathy Tanner talks about how almost every generation has to kind of go through and reformulate theology based on lived experience, I mean, Just War is a concrete example of that. And that's the way I don't find it helpful. I think at one point in the project I was saying, I found myself saying Just War theory doesn't have like an updated picture of war. We need to update it. But I actually found that it got much more towards of like the mechanics of the theology, and that because I mean you could substitute Congo for World War II, and now we have a more contemporary example. But 50 years from now, war changes again. And so I found myself actually it was the theological mechanics were actually at the kind of the center of it all. So. And I think I come out saying basically, you know, I just don't know if Christians offer a position on war. I mean, I find it more constructive to think about in the context of Congo, here is how Archbishop Catalico is inhabiting the space. And it just doesn't seem to be quite as overdetermined by these concepts. I mean, I love when Adorno talks about the disenchantment of concepts. I mean, I think sometimes concepts can kind of overdetermine these ethical debates. In that sense, I found war to be a very enchanted concept that is completely overdetermining the very way we think theologically. And so in that sense, I feel like a disenchantment of war is also kind of theological. Yeah.
So there's a tension, I think, in your paper between this descent into ordinariness mm-hmm. that you're talking about and also the choice of Congo as a place that where all these events that are unique are taking place. So how do you resolve the tension between Congo being a particular place that challenges you in a particular way, and obviously a place that has all the dramatic dimensions that you're describing, and the descent into ordinariness.
And
you need to have a place like Congo in order to have an authentic lived theology, and in that sense is not reproducing a certain kind of victimhood by chasing after the ambulance, as it were.
Right.
I don't know if I'm putting it.
No, I love that. It's great.
So what does it do to choose a particular place like Congo? If we're going to be reflecting on places, we have to be aware of what our choice is, why we choose those places, and what those places do to us. Right? If we're going to be attentive to the ordinariness of carnal life,
absolutely.
Why Congo?
Yes.
Why not Charlottesville?
Yeah. So I think the question about self-reflexive about Congo for me emerges a very contingent kind of focus. I mean, when I began to think about it, Charles mentioned that I've had some involvement with the Duke Center for Reconciliation, and to be honest, it was, I thought I was going to focus on northern Uganda, and it was conversations with Congolese folks who were sharing about, and there was quite a lot of talk about what it, certainly kind of what American foreign policy was, and as you know, as you one tours around Congo, you often get, why is your American government supporting Rwanda? And so there was a sense of kind of being held by the collar and being like addressed almost in a Levinasian sense, you know. And so there is a kind of contingency to the project that I think that's important. And then I wouldn't link dissent to the ordinary at all with any sort of kind of extreme situation. I mean, if anything, I try to kind of problematize the humanitarian dependence on needing a cause. But I think the dissent in the ordinary could be, is as Mary shows in Good Samaritan, I mean, it's very much the same sensibility. And I think it's more of, when I talk about time, it's the dissent in the ordinary is about what kind of time is necessary to see how things play out, as opposed to courting danger. I mean, danger is very socially constructed anyway, but... So I would stress the contingency of Congo in terms of just concrete conversations and friendships. And then I don't see that necessarily tied, the idea of a descent of the ordinary is tied to a Northern Ireland or a Congo. Or,
but those places don't call the theologian to have any specific commitments.
In Congo?
Yeah, because if we're going to be respecting particularity, right?
Yeah.
If the theology is respecting the particularity.
Yeah.
What is it about Congo that needs to be respected? Or is Congo just an example for, a metaphor, a trope for processes?
Absolutely. And I would say Congo's inside of... I mean, one of the things that Congo's helped me see is how deeply it penetrates even everyday life here. I mean, if you take the resource dimension of the whole war between the coltan and the cell phones and the PlayStations, I mean... In a global economy, I mean, Congo hits home very quickly. I mean, when I was giving the talk at Pete's university, I mean, there's a mining company operates like 20 minutes outside of Ashland that sourced a lot of these resources. So, I mean, so there isn't a choice in that sense about whether or not we're implicated or not. And that extends to foreign policy. But I would say specifically, I mean, I mentioned Conrad's Heart of Darkness. I mean, Congo has a very specific place in the Western imaginary, and it's constantly reproduced by a lot of Christian groups too, and so that's internal. And now we can begin to talk about what's internal to theology and the discipline of theology and the legacy of missions and the colonial project and the way that certain categories are prioritized and some of the biases that you describe. When we go to the discipline of theology, we see that actually those biases were established in places like Congo. In 1888, you know. So in that sense, when I talk about acknowledgement and having textual bodies that are transformed by encounters, I'm talking about changing a discipline that's in need of redemption. And Congo is at the very center of it.
I asked you this question because Haiti, in case I'm more familiar with, I have a colleague, who's been doing research on disaster evangelism.
Yeah.
So it's
right.
About these evangelicals that really want to put themselves at the edge of human experience where the
yeah.
devil is
right.
its most
yes.
stark
yes.
because they have this idea of dominion. And so
yeah.
they're going to take the war to the real heart of darkness that
yes.
you're talking about.
Yeah.
So all these places are places that really carry, as you just put it, a whole historical reality
yeah.
right, that's behind this kind of missionizing, colonialism
yes, yes.
That is tied to the construction of not just theology, but religious studies and
yes.
anthropology.
Yes.
So everyone's implicated. In
yes,
this
yes.
And so I think that's a tension that in your paper,
yeah.
it's a wonderful paper, and I think
yeah.
it's a tension that probably could, you know,
yeah.
you could play with that tension productively.
That's extremely helpful. I really appreciate that. Yeah.
Let me just ask one question on this, and then this will be the last question, and we can walk to dinner and have some drinks and enjoy a nice meal.
But the this term you just used, the theological mechanics, this became sort of a primary concentration of yours. And I take it by that you mean sort of how to craft the theological investments and moves and also how to do this in the form of story and narration. And I guess my question just is about that tension, if it was a tension for you, the tension between story and narrative and the theological mechanics. And I often wonder, so how far, like at what point does the work cease to be theology and become story or nonfiction narrative?
Yeah.
I don't think there's I think story actually can do all the work in the end.
Yes.
That you need.
Right.
I don't accept that kind of distinction, but I'm just wondering how you negotiate that. Of course, you're writing a doctoral dissertation, and you have to be mindful of those.
Yeah. I was reflecting on the when I looked at it towards the end, I was kind of surprised. Like, there isn't as much theology as I thought there was going to be here. And I'm talking a lot about political economy. And what was helpful, and Mary talks a bit about this in her book about stipulations of relevance, and like to be focused on Good Samaritan is already deeply, it's a Christology, it's a vast theology. But she doesn't need to say that out loud. And I think likewise, I found that some of the focus, beginning from a civilian's perspective as opposed from the state perspective and the use of force. And some of these shifts, to me, were very Christologically loaded. And that I would say that's where some theological mechanics are going on. I try to articulate that. But, I mean, I struggle in the same ways about whether or not it's necessary. I'm writing a committee of theologians who want to hear it. I guess I wonder what's at stake in the tension. I mean, if you don't say it, what's at stake? Like, what's at stake? Where is this lead? You know what I mean? Like, I think we both have a restlessness about it matters. Mm-hmm. But why? I mean, so I think I'm still kind of wrestling with that. Mm-hmm. But I think a narrative that is fully loaded with theological stuff but doesn't have to say it is.
I just don't, at what point does a theological narrative that is framed in stories, as it becomes more storied, cease to be a theological narrative?
Yeah.
And?
Yeah, what criteria would be used to make that judgment?
Yeah.
I think that's, why does this matter? I think it's more the criteria question.
Mm-hmm.
Somewhere here there's a criteria about what's theological and what's not.
Right.
And that seems to me where the a critical conversation could happen about.
Is it going to be resolved in this meeting?
Thank you so much.